Allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is Ho, H to the O-V. I used to move snowflakes by the O-Z. I guess even back then you can call me CEO of the R-O-C. Ho, fresh out the frying pan into the fire. I be the music biz number one supplier. Fly it in a piece of paper bearing my name. Got the hottest chick in the game wearing my chain. That's right, ho, ho. Not D-O-C, but similar to them letters. No one could do it better. I check cheddar like a food inspector. My homie Strick told me, dude, finish your breakfast. So that's what I'ma do. Take you back to the dude with the Lexus. Fast forward the Jews and
what's
the Lexus.
Good, everybody? And welcome to an episode of the Untouched CIS Podcast with your host, yours truly, Jai Shields, here on this Friday, April the 5th, the year 2024. And boy, we have a lot to talk about and a lot in store for you here on this weekend program. It is Final Four weekend across the sport of college basketball. Two Final Four games in the men's side and the women's side. I'll preview and give you my commentary on all four games as the afternoon and as the day and the show moves along. Major League Baseball, obviously, the Yankees have their home opener today, which is already underway at the time of this recording, up in the Bronx, after they had a nice little earthquake to get things started during batting practice earlier this morning. Three teams give you my commentary. You know, the Orioles obviously give you where they stand after the first six games of the season. The Mets finally got off the deck and won themselves a baseball game for a change. And the LA Dodgers, who are, again, on their way to cruise to another 100-win season. And every way you look, you see that Mookie Betts is the top of the leaderboard in major hitting categories across the National League. Joel Embiid returns and lays in the NBA. Julius Randle's gone for the rest of the season for the Knicks, but that fazed them none. They found a way to get the job done, winning the game over the Sacramento Kings last night. Get into that. And a few NFL notes: Stephon Diggs traded to the Houston Texans, and Hassan Reddick traded to the New York Jets. But let us first begin with college basketball here today with the men's and the women's Final Four. I'll begin with the ladies first, since their games are tonight. And first up on the menu, game number one, NC State versus South Carolina, rather. South Carolina, I mean, what more can you say? This is the perfect undefeated team, 36-0, looking to kind of challenge the old guard, who they might see in the national championship on Sunday afternoon if all things work out in their favor tonight against NC State, in terms of the old guard and new guard in terms of a potential dynasty within the sport of college basketball. I mean, they are currently 11-point favorites over the NC State Wolfpack, who are heading into this game 31-6 after taking care of business in the Elite Eight up in Portland, Oregon on Sunday afternoon on Easter Sunday. I mean, you take a look at USC, the original USC, is because I went and took a college trip down there in 2019. Everywhere you look, you know, they called themselves and pride themselves on being the quote-unquote real USC. Dawn Staley, what a tremendous coach she is. Her team's in a fourth straight Final Four, won AP Coach of the Year. They're just locked in, laser-focused. I mean, they blow out teams out of the water. I mean, they've had wins by 82 points, by 70 points, and they're just a sensational, sensational basketball program. They've gotten 39, 40 points from their bench, which is by far the best throughout March Madness out of all the teams that made the field. Their bench averaging damn near 40 points a game, which is a blessing because Staley's allowed to keep her lineup fresh. You know, you don't have the same five to seven ladies out there on the court, you know, for 40 minutes all at once, and they wear themselves out and they're running on fumes by the time the Sweet 16 comes along. So obviously she deserves tremendous credit for that. And the team's just good. I mean, they do, like we say with UConn and the men's side, we say on here, there's not a single thing that I look at South Carolina and I see that they do wrong. They are a well coached basketball team. Dawn Staley, who is a player's coach, but also has that Dan Hurley, that Saban, that that Belichick, that Phil Jackson sort of that Pat Riley philosophy is like, hey, I can be you guys' friend, but if you piss me off and our standards start to drop, I'll be your own worst enemy, and I'll have my foot so far up your ass, you'll be shitting out shoelaces by the time you turn 40. And that's exactly how she is. She holds the players to a high standard. Expects nothing short of perfection. She wants them dialed in, focused, and just nose to the grindstone, handle your business, do your job, and they do that, so they're able to balance that wave between, being happy-go-lucky and just having fun and not getting too hard on themselves, and they also know that, hey, we're here to do a job, and that's to win national championships ad infinitum. So give her tremendous credit. I mean, I look at everything that they do well, and I don't see how in the hell, quite honestly, I mean, they're 11.5-point favorites for a reason, for crying out loud, how NC State they have a chance. Now, if you look at NC State and how they did on Easter Sunday against Texas, when 76-66, they did a good job, obviously, outscoring Texas specifically in the first half. They just an onslaught, second quarter outscored them 24-17 and held Texas to 31 first half points, which is a tremendous account towards their defense. Isaiah James made seven threes, and obviously was the focal point offensively for them in the game. Scored 27 points, 9-17 from the field. Just did an absolutely sensational job. The team as a whole shot 50% from three, 45% from the field, and just suffocated Texas defensively as the game went along. And they're going to have to basically try and do what they can to do that to stop South Carolina, one of the more efficient offenses in all of, not just the SEC, but in college basketball, which is why they are one of the final four teams standing. But should be an intriguing game. But I think in the Battle of the Carolinas, it will be South Carolina that will be 37-0 and preparing to play in yet another national championship game coming up on Sunday. And then what people would call the main event of the night the main event, honestly, of the entire Final Four weekend, depending on who you ask, is UConn versus Iowa. Paige Buchers versus Caitlin Clark. Obviously, a lot has been made about Caitlin Clark and the record-breaking season that she's had this year for the Iowa Hawkeyes. She went off, scoring 41 points, had a double-double, was absolutely sensational against LSU on Monday night, which we discussed earlier in the week. And Paige Buchers, with a heroic performance of herself, despite the fact that her and her UConn team had issues at the free throw line and kept the door open for USC, keeping their margin of error very, very slim, nursing a 6-7-8-point lead late in the fourth quarter on Monday night. But they got the job done nevertheless. Arguably the two best players in college basketball over the span of the last handful of seasons are going head to head. It should be a sensational game. Iowa's 3.5-point favorite. UConn coming in at 33-5. The 3 seed Iowa is 33-4. The battle of the hunted versus the huntee. Champion versus challenger. The old wave with UConn, Gion Auriemma. The dynasty that he's built up in Storrs, Connecticut, where he obviously had the 4-peat. Did not make the Final Four in 2023, made it 2022, and they're back again with a vengeance. They winners are 5 in a row, as is Iowa, who is currently with Caitlin Clark, with this being her final game as a Iowa Hawkeye. It looks like, like Eminem, one shot, one opportunity, you got to seize the moment. In terms of, and I've heard a lot of this discussion, so might as well give you my commentary on this. I've heard a lot of discussion about Caitlin Clark's legacy if she does not win if she does not win a national championship, can she be considered to be the GOAT of women's college basketball? And I would absolutely agree with that. You know, you take a look at baseball is weird. I am of the opinion that you cannot win you cannot be considered the greatest anything if you have not won a championship. And obviously I understand that Paige Buchers has not won a national championship either since she's been at UConn, but nobody is saying, you know, Paige Buchers with the, you know, she hasn't broken the records that Caitlin Clark has. Furthermore, no one's walking around saying she's the greatest college basketball player of all time until the likes of essentially the female 21st century version of Pistol Pete Maravich. With Caitlin Clark, it's a little bit of a different conversation. And you can't, especially in a sport like basketball, you cannot be, where there's only 10 players on the court and you're one of 10. You cannot, under any circumstances, be considered the quote-unquote GOAT of anything, you know, without a championship. With as good of a program that team is, the fact that she is by far the highlight attraction of that Iowa Hawkeyes basketball team and one of the more premier attractions and top five, top three best and most polarizing players in women's college basketball today, you cannot break all these records and be compared to the likes of Pistol Pete and be called, you know, the Steph Curry of women's basketball. That, you know, the active player, you know, the equivalent of Steph Curry in the women's basketball, and not win a championship. You just can't. You cannot be considered a GOAT in football, basketball, especially those team sports, and, you know, hockey. I don't know. I'm not a hockey expert. I can't answer that for you. Baseball, I tend to lean toward that. Yeah, you should be, you know, have at least a championship under your belt to be considered a GOAT. But baseball's a little bit different. You're one of nine throughout the lineup. You know, it's a very statistics-driven sport in terms of, you know, your levels of greatness. You play 162 games. You can be a great player on a last-place team. Look at Mike Trout and be considered an all-time great. Now, he's not an immortal, but he's, you know, but you can be considered an all-time great. He ain't the GOAT either, but you can consider him, you know, an all-time great. Those that don't, that turn the other cheek when it comes to Barry Bonds with steroids, they call him the GOAT. I think it's, you know, I disagree, but listen, you can, it's easier to make an argument for a guy like Barry Bonds to be the quote unquote GOAT of baseball than it is to make the argument for Charles Barkley or Dan Marino to be considered the GOAT of the NBA and the NFL. Those two sports, especially football and basketball, you gotta at least have a championship underneath your belt to be considered the greatest. And women's college basketball, I understand the UConn dynasty. I understand how great South Carolina is. It's just no excuse. You're great and you're talked about and you're hyped about and you are praised as the Pistol Pete Maravich of your sport in modern day version. You gotta win yourself a championship. You have to. No excuse. No questions asked. You cannot be considered the GOAT if you don't have a championship. So in terms of legacy, like when we 10, 15, 20, 25 years from now, and Caitlin Clark has her own 30 for 30, you know, 20, 25 years down the road, there has to be footage of her hoisting up a national championship trophy. You know, we talk about in terms of the men's game, the greatest college basketball players of all time. Kareem, I mean, God, I mean, we all know how ridiculously accoladed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was at the college level, playing for UCLA. I mean, here's a guy, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, that won a national championship three times, three-peated, 1966 through 1969. Kareem three-peated. Jordan. Now he's not. Now nobody considers Michael Jordan to be the. I mean, he's a damn good college basketball player. Nobody considers him to be an all-time great as a college basketball player. The GOAT, I should say, at the college basketball level. He's got a national championship. Everybody, and I mean everybody, and their mother talks about how Christian Laettner is one of the greatest college basketball players of all time. You know, that played for those Duke teams in the 90s. You know how many national championships Christian Laettner has? He has two. too. So if we look at the men's side and we evaluate the all-time great, not NBA, but all-time great college basketball player, the all-time great college basketball player, they at bare minimum, at least the two I gave you, Jordan had the one, but the two I gave you, Leitner and Kareem, those guys at the bare minimum, have two. Bill Russell, God rest his soul, when he played at the University of San Francisco back in the day, I understand it's the 1950s, but he has two championships. So the standard cannot change. You want to be considered the GOAT, the greatest of all time. Immortal, all-time great, she's already accomplished that. But if you want the title of being the greatest of all time, this Iowa season for her has to end in the national championship. Has to. Paige Bueger's coming off of a season-ending injury last year, back in the final. Everything sugar and spice and everything nice. Caitlin Clark, with all the attention that surrounded her throughout this entire season, it's got to end in a national championship in order for her legacy to be cemented as the greatest basketball player in the history of the college game, at least of her era in the 21st century. Has to. Now, some people disagree, but hey, it ain't their show. It's mine. So, but in my humble opinion, it's got to end for her in the national championship. Has to. Now, in terms of the men's side of things, with their Final Four coming up tomorrow on TBS. By the way, and I understand, you know, they CBS, because they couldn't, you know, afford to foot the bill, you know, by themselves for whatever the case might be. I don't understand why the final, and what always like this, even into 2011 when they brought in the Turner Networks, I don't understand why the Final Four in the national championship game, we got to put it on TBS. I don't understand it. And the thing I don't understand also is that I understand, you know, I disagree, but the people that love to do the streaming argument will say, well, they want people to stream this at the third, blah, 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 which I don't understand. I don't agree with. I think that's kind of like a half truth, but you know, if you want to say people stream television. I have yet, and I would love to interview whoever the head person in charge of either Turner Sports, Sean McManus of CBS, or somebody with the NCAA. I would love to interview them and ask them the question, guys, what exactly is the benefit for you guys putting the Final Four in the national championship game on TBS. It's TBS. The NBA doesn't put the NBA Finals on TNT for a reason. Okay? Baseball doesn't put the World Series on TBS for a reason. Yet, you guys feel the need, albeit March Madness is a countrywide phenomenon of a sporting event, it loses its uniqueness and panache to a certain degree after 2-3 weeks have gone by. You know, it's not like we're not, you know, the first 2-3 days of the tournament where everyone's watching college basketball from noon to midnight. Like that's long gone. The actual meat and potatoes of the tournament is over with. The final, not to diminish or take anything away from the Final Four, because you know it's the Final Four. I mean, I'm not poo-pooing it, but I'm in terms of the immense popularity where people move heaven and earth to get their college basketball fix, that ship has sailed now. Where, you know, we'll TBS and TNT will find where True TV is and bookmark it on our cable. But that's over. It's the Final Four, the best of the best, the best four teams in men's D1 college basketball. And we got to put the games on TBS. For the life of me, I don't understand. And always didn't used to be that way. Even after 2011, where they had the contract where they put the first and second round games on the Turner networks. And over the last, I want to say like maybe five, six, 7 years or so, we alternate with putting the Final Four on TBS and the national championship game on TBS. Why that's the? I mean, think about it. The game is at 6 o'clock and about 8:50, 9 o'clock on a Saturday. I don't get it. I do not get it. You're putting the national championship game and the national semifinals on cable. Not streaming where you can sit up here and say, well, we use it to make an extra buck and more people stream and play that card. You're putting it from linear television to cable. Try to find the sense in that for me, please. You're putting it on cable. Which obviously, and I don't know why the NCAA continues to go through the charade, because they know good and damn well that the rating they get on TBS always, no matter who's in the game, what the storyline is, it always pales in comparison to the rating on CBS. It always does. Always. The women's game, their national championship, take a good guess where it is. ABC. It's on ABC. Linear network television, where everybody can find it. Where they know the game will be promoted ad infinitum on Good Morning America. And ABC World News and all that other stuff. Under the big Disney umbrella. Rather than have the Final Four National Championship on CBS, will be promoted on 60 Minutes. They'll promote it during the commercial breaks of their NCIS and FBI shows during the week. And the Lazbeth, whatever the fuck the name of that TV show is. And Tracker and Survivor. You know, CBS This Morning with Gail King and Nate. They'll promote it like you wouldn't believe. TBS, it's like, what? CBS does not air programming worthwhile to watch. Due respect, they don't. What Friends and Family Guy reruns, and that is the end of it. Nobody watches TBS outside of sports like they do in comparison to CBS, and that's fact. So why they what are they trying to throw them a bone? They throw them a bone by allowing them to broadcast the tournament from the first round to the Elite Eight. And that should be enough. The Final Four National Championship game always should be on CBS. A, because it's CBS's baby. Turner only jumps in for the tournament and that for 3 weeks and that's it. Two, if that. CBS, they're broadcasting college basketball games the weekend after the Army-Navy game. So what? That's from mid-December all the way through the month of March. That's their product. That's their baby. That'd be like the NFL having having Monday Night Football on ESPN and ABC, and they wait until it's time for ESPN to broadcast a playoff game or two, and they stick the playoff game on freaking Freeform. Like, what are we doing here? Put it on CBS. Period. End of story. I don't care about Turner and this, that, the third, and partnership. I don't care. Again, that'd be like the NFL, that'd be like ESPN and ABC, who do Monday Night Football from early September, if you want to include a preseason game, and from August to mid-January, and when it comes time for them to get the Super Bowl in 2027, they put the Super Bowl on Freeform on Disney XD. That's not the way you do it. You put the national championship game, not every other year, like it's an election year. National Championship game and the Final Four on CBS. CBS. Not TBS, CBS. You get a higher rating, more people have it and are subscribed to it, and it's network linear over-the-air television. I mean, the CBS, what? CBS 2 months ago just got finished having the Super Bowl. People know where CBS is, how to get it, whether it's Paramount Plus. They know how to get it. They have every household in America, some form or fashion, has CBS. Either they have it the regular old-fashioned way, you know, cable. They have analog television where they just get the regular local channels. They have it. Or if they have Paramount Plus, they have CBS that way. Everybody has CBS, and you're going to get a better rating every single time you put the, I don't care who's in the game, the rating is going to be better on CBS compared to TBS. It just is. You think the NBA, again, do you think the NBA, and people love, and the NBA on TNT crew is great. Broadcasters are sensational. That broadcast games and Inside the NBA is a Hall of Fame Emmy Award winning show. But I don't consider it a coincidence that the NBA every single year puts the NBA Finals on not ESPN even not even ESPN and not on TNT. They put it on linear over the air network television. ABC. Baseball, same deal. It's not a coincidence why you haven't seen a World Series played on Fox. Played on TBS. They have put them on Fox for the last 25 plus years. They haven't put a game on, a World Series on TBS for good reason. If you think their ratings stink on Fox, they put the ratings on TBS, and I guarantee you nobody would watch the World Series. And I'll even settle for splitting the baby in half, putting the Final Four in TBS and the National Championship game every year on CBS. But this National Championship Final Four on TBS foolishness has got to stop. Every single time they have it, it irks the hell out of me. I'm so sick of it. Put the damn thing on network television on CBS. Everybody has it. We're going to watch the CBS next weekend for the Masters. We watched CBS 2 months ago with the Super Bowl. We know where CBS is. You're a sports fan, you know where CBS is. Whether you're a college basketball fan, you know where CBS is. If you're a college football and or an NFL fan, you know where CBS is. You're a golf fan, you know where CBS is. Put the damn thing on CBS. I would think the NCAA would want to put their Final Four in a national championship game consistently on a year-on-year basis on a network that everybody's familiar with, that they know is going to get ample promotion in the days leading up to the game. And they're going to put the national championship game in prime time on a Monday night, and it's going to get a big-time rating. Not 5.5 million people on TBS. Seriously? That irks me, and putting the Final Four in the football stands, which I've screamed about when we had Timbo Russo on the show back in the summertime. We yelled about that as well. I cannot stand it when they put the Final Four in these football stadiums. Again, it's another move by the NCAA that just makes no freaking sense. I mean, that's another one. The Final Four on TBS and the Final Four in football stadiums are two of the most brain-dead, most asinine decision made. I mean, it's just dumb. Dumb! Dumb. Why not? I don't understand. Why not put the game in an actual NBA arena? If you want to jack up the prices to high heavens like the NFL does with the Super Bowl, have at it. But why not put it in an NBA arena that's an actual venue suited to host a basketball game? That That when the Super Bowl was played in Los Angeles a few years back, that'd be like the NFL putting Super Bowl 56 on USA, and then sticking a game instead of in SoFi Stadium, they played a game at Dodger Stadium. What? Again, NCAA as clueless as the day is long. It's a safety hazard. The fact they have to build the court on a platform like it's a stage to getting ready to host a Dua Lipa concert, it drives me up the wall. You shouldn't be have to take walk up and walk down off a basketball court. These big ass dudes running at 100 miles an hour after a loose ball have to have in the back of their mind not to fall off the stage 3.5-4 feet and bust their ass. It's just dumb. The sight lines are horrendous. Unless you are a broadcaster or sitting on the media rows courtside of the game, why in the hell would you ever go to the Final Four? Why? Even if you're part of the student section that wins a raffle to go to the Final Four, the sight lines from where they sit behind the basket is horrible. The sight lines in the actual regular football sideline seats, horrible. Why sit in the upper deck? Why waste your time? There's no court side for the final. Why waste your time? I understand why they do well to make money so they can, put 80,000 and watch, get 80,000 ticket, admission prices to watch a basketball game. Yeah, but even then it makes no damn sense. I'm no economist, but wouldn't I think it would be better if you, less people, the more money you could charge? Because eventually people are going to say, to hell with this, I'm going to watch the damn thing at home. Because basketball is one of those sports where unless you are on top of the action in person, there's no sense in going. There's no sense, and I've tried it. Wizards and Hornets, March of 2017, I practically was sitting in the rafters. There was no point in being, you got a better perspective and better view of the game on TV than sitting in the upper deck, miles away from the action. Can't tell what's a foul, what's not, what's a travel, double dribble, backcourt violation. You lost. Whether a ball was tipped before it went out, you're wasting your time. And it's a safety hazard for the players. I can't stand the tacky look that it gives off on television. Ugh! You want to put the game and you want to put the Final Four in Arizona? Put it where in the Footprint Center where the Suns play. If it's good enough to put tournament games in NBA arenas, rounds 1 through the Elite Eight, why isn't it good enough for a national championship game? Hell, the NBA, the women's game does it. The Final Four is in Cleveland. They're playing a game at the Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse where the Cavaliers play. And I guarantee you the overall environment for the games tonight and the national championship on Sunday are going to be worlds better than the actual in-the-building environment at the games coming up this weekend on the men's side. Can't stand it. Drives me insane. We got to walk up the steps and sit there on a platform, not to mention the rims are stiff as hell because it's not a traditional regular basketball arena, so you're watching like the first 10 minutes of the game, brick after brick, because the rim and the netting is stiff. It's tiring. Yeah, I can't stand it. The piss poor sight lines of the people. It's not a basketball arena. It's a football stadium. Seeing the players essentially jog 50 yards just to get... What? I mean, come on the hell on. I hate it. I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. I hate the Final Four being played in football stadiums more than the expensive prices of Super Bowls. I hate it. I can't stand it. Again, that would be like when Super Bowl 60, when it's played in the greater Bay Area, that would be like the NFL taking the Super Bowl from Levi's Stadium and having them play the game at AT&T Stadium where the damn Giants play. Dumb, moronic, asinine. You put a college basketball national championship game in a basketball appropriate arena, in a basketball appropriate venue. Sticking in these football stadiums, it makes me sick. I can't stand it. It's the most tackiest look in all of sports. It grinds my gears no end. Anyway, my annual Final Four rant. I have to get it. Every single year I see it, and I saw the pictures this week of basically what the Final Four court looks like, all constructed and the building all dressed up to be a supersized basketball arena. It makes my damn skin crawl. I can't stand it. I cannot freaking stand it. Anyway, to the games itself. How about UConn? Obviously, we've talked about ad infinitum, how UConn can do no wrong, and you'd have a hard time picking out and finding out and investigating the issues with the UConn Huskies basketball program, because this team is just on an elite run that we have not seen in the sport in a long, long time. I mean, look about it. Think about this and look at this for a minute. If you're a UConn Huskies basketball fan, UConn Huskies have won 14 tournament games in the Sweet 16 or later. 14 straight games. That's the best in all of college football. They held Illinois in the Elite Eight on Saturday to 50 minutes of real time, damn near an hour of real time, without recording a basket. Process that for a minute in your head. 50 minutes without a basket. 50 minutes. We all know how great Dan Hurley is. Tremendous credit. Wants the best for his players, from his players, at the highest level. He wants them to blow every single team that they play and expects nothing but perfection. I mean, you take a look at what they provide on the court. The 7'2" sophomore, Donovan Klingon, and what he's able to bring to that team in terms of being the elite force inside for him. And Tristan Newton, their first team All-American guard. They're going to need a good game from him. You know, obviously there are times where he you know, ebbs and flows of his game, where he's not a primary efficient option as a scorer, but they're going to need a dominant game from him to get the ball rolling a little bit. If Alabama's defense takes away the threat of clinging and inside, and they got to be able to just capitalize and dominate the game inside with their mid-range game and dominate the game inside the paint. Because if they're, for whatever reason, now they've been on an elite stretch, and I've told you guys that, hey, they're due to foul up, they're due to play a close game against some team that's going to give them a run for their money. And it could be Saturday, it could be Monday night, you just never know. But they have to be able to find a way to get the job done. Especially inside. If not, you take a look at how they are as a three-point shooting team. They shoot 35% as a team from three, which ranked 69th in all of college basketball. And they also sat outside of the top 20 of the 68 teams in three-point shooting percentage that made the tournament. So they got to be able to dominate and play their game inside in order for them to win. And they start. And even though Klingon is their best player, Tristan Newton has to get off to a good start shooting the basketball for them as well. It's imperative, because if they don't, I could see, especially considering the way Alabama played their last time out in the Elite Eight against against Clemson. You know, where they, you know, they scored 89 points to beat Clemson, and they're going to have to, like we've mentioned, when, in comparison to UConn's opponents all season long, you play UConn, you got to be prepared to bring your offense. You cannot beat these guys 61-59. You have to be able to bring your offense and match them score for score, possession by possession. Now, in terms of what Alabama did against Clemson last week, scoring 89, I mean, they've scored 89 points in back-to-back games, and as a team, they shot 44% from three and 46% from the field. So if you're a UConn fan, the one thing that would make you nervous is considering the fact of how efficient Alabama is at the three ball in comparison to you. And there could be moments of opportunities where if UConn isn't, you know, has an off day by their standards, or if Alabama is able to hold them in check for the most part defensively, they can make up for, you know, the twos, you know, two, three possessions in a row if they knock down a few threes. If they can keep pace with UConn by their outside shot working and hitting on a consistent basis, UConn has an opportunity to get upset in this game. But which is, again, why I say Newton's got to be able to shoot the ball well firsthand and efficiently to keep the pressure on Alabama. Because Alabama can sit up here and say, hey, as long as if we force them to take outside shots and they're not hitting for them, and on the other hand, we're pulling up from three, you know, ad infinitum, and we're making threes, you know, and our three-point conversion ratio to theirs is, you know, 3-1, we're going to be in good shape throughout the 40 minutes of the game coming up on Saturday night. So if you're UConn, limit the damage from three outside from Alabama. And if you're Alabama, put UConn in an early hole and get those threes flying and get them going for you early to put the pressure on the defending national champions. Because it's going to be a time, I don't know when and against who, where the pressure could get to UConn in terms of saying, hey, you're the defending national champion. You've made it this far. You're one win away from returning to the national championship game, two wins away from repeating as national champions for the first time in over 15 years. Alabama playing with house money, you know, it's put up a shut up. We've seen that happen in sports many a time. We've seen it. So I'm intrigued to see if Alabama can get out to a hot start and make UConn sweat for the first time in this tournament. And we've discussed this about a handful of weeks ago. You look at UConn's resume in tournament play, whether it be Big East or the NCAA tournament. It's been blowout city for them the last two seasons every single time you turn around. Eventually, they're going to play in a white knuckler. And I think Alabama has what it takes to provide that. And if UConn's not careful, they could get upset come late Saturday afternoon. Game one between NC State and Purdue, I look at it like this. DJ Burns versus Zach Edey will be an intriguing matchup to look at in terms of what both of these two players can provide inside. Edey, obviously the 7'4", the 7'4" stud inside. We discussed the amount of records that he's set and broken within the NCAA tournament this year and over the last handful of seasons. You know, they're one of the best half-court offensive teams in the nation. Edey commands and just sucks in and brings in and attracts attention inside to the post, which opens up opportunities for Purdue outside. And they made sure throughout the offseason, give Matt Painter, the coach, tremendous credit on recruiting guys that can hit, that are elite and efficient shooters from the outside. Because, you know, when you have that stud 7'4" sitting right there in the middle and inside in the post, he attracts all the attention. So, you know, you get double team, triple team, and all the attention goes to him inside. What happens when you bring in attention to the inside? Defense is going to lax, and they're going to have wide open shots and wide open shooters on the outside on the perimeter. And Purdue is taking advantage of that, which is one of the main reasons why, with them being the one seed, why they've been able to make it to the Final Four to this point. So they're able to do that, and they hit, and they not only they knocked down their shots, they hit it with absolute. They hit it with absolute consistency. Now, the thing with Purdue that if you're NC State, you want to attack and you want to make a point of emphasis is the turnovers. They turn over the basketball at times, Purdue, at an alarming rate, all things being considered. So if Purdue turns over the basketball ad infinitum, and NC State's going to be in this game until the better end. They take care of it. I think they win the game. I think they win the game quite handily. Now, if you take a look at where they, again, three-point shooting, from last season to this season, they ranked second nationally in three-point shooting at 40%. So limit the damage outside with the three and force turnovers if you're NC State. And you take a look at NC State and how they did against Duke last Sunday. They were able to force Duke to turn over the basketball 9 times and got 13 points off of turnovers. So they got to be able to force the basketball and steal some possessions from the mighty Duke offensive attack. Now they don't shoot the three ball well. They shot 23%, 3 of 13 from three against Duke last week, but they were able to make their shots. 46% they shot as a team from the field, and they got to also be able to make their free throws. You know, Duke was 21 of 26 from the stripe, even though the Wolfpack won the game by 8. They shot 17 of 23 due to the division at 73. Might as well round up to 74% from the free throw line. So you got to be able, you cannot, especially with this team. And you get into a point with a lot of teams throughout the tournament, and obviously you can make a argument whether the refs help them out or not. Who knows? Won't get into that debate. But obviously, Edie gets helped by the fact that he's 7'4", and a lot of these teams that they played in this tournament, you know, whether it be Tennessee, Utah State, they panic, and they all of a sudden think every single time, every single possession that in which the ball is in Edie's hands down low, he has to get fouled. Rather than him, he has the ball, best player, tallest, biggest player on the court. Let him score, let him have his 2 points. And defenses and teams fall into the trap of he gets the ball in his hands, be automatically every single time got to foul him. What happens, the fouls stack up, they pile up, and he's going in every single Purdue possession where the ball's in his hands, they're getting 3 points at a time. Ad infinitum, and it stockpiles and snowballs, and all of a sudden, the game is blown, it's gone, and the scoring avalanche is out of control, and your game's over, and you're packing your hefty bags, getting ready to head back to campus for class on Monday morning. So NC State cannot fall into that trap, force turnovers, and limit the damage, not even necessarily of Edie inside, but make sure that Edie and his outside shooting contemporaries do not take over the game. You know, you got a game of pick your poison. Force turnovers and pick your poison in terms of who you want to have. What part of Purdue's offense do you want beating you? Edie, their best player, or their outside shooting? If you're NC State, and on NC State's side of things, they're playing with house money. First Final Four appearance in 41 years. Put together a showing and a performance to be proud of at the end of the day, and for you again to win a basketball game. Force turnovers, and on your side of things, on things in terms of what you can control over the offensive side, you get to the foul line, make your damn free throws. That's been the story of the tournament these last two weeks or so, on the men's side and the women's side, is with a lead, not making your free throws, leaving the door open. We saw it with Houston and Texas A&M. We saw it with and on the women's side with UConn and USC the other night. You got to be able to make your free throws. When you're ahead, to put teams away, and when you're trailing, make free throws to keep the pressure on your opponent late in the second half. You have to make your free throws, because if you have an off night from the stripe, it could be the difference between you advancing to play for a national championship on Monday night, or you packing your hefty bags preparing for the long flight home to North Carolina as Final Four losers. So, but we should have a great two nights back to back, Friday and Saturday night, of college basketball. I'm looking forward to it tremendously. Switching gears now to the baseball diamond. Just a couple of addendums. Shout out to the Orioles. They couldn't hit a lick off of, they could not hit a lick on Wednesday afternoon after a 5-hour rain delay. Give them credit. This team is as mentally tough of a baseball team as you're ever going to find in the sport right now. They could not hit a lick off of Cole Reagans, who they absolutely had no answers for. 6 1/3, one hit. Walked 2 batters, struck out 7, slept walk through the game until the 8th and 9th inning, were able to score 2 runs in back-to-back innings. James McCann, of all people, 2-0 count runners on 3rd and 2nd with 2 out, Orioles down at a final out, rips a game-winning walk-off 2-run single into left field. And in a game, and in a series in which the Orioles did not lead for all but 1 inning, they found a way to win a series 2 out of 3 and finish their opening homestand of the 2024 campaign with a 4-2 record as they're set to begin a road trip beginning this weekend, this afternoon, against the Pittsburgh Pirates. They're in Pittsburgh for 3, off day Monday, in Boston for 3 for the first time this season, and they come back home next weekend for a 6-game homestand to take on the Milwaukee Brewers and the Minnesota Twins. Then it's on the road again in 2 weeks time, where they play the aforementioned Kansas City Royals, then 3 on the road against the Angels, then an off day, and then they're home they're home for a 7-game series to wrap up the month of April against the A's and the New York Yankees, bleeding into the month of May. But give the Orioles tremendous credit getting off the deck. They deserve their praise too. The Mets, finally, speaking of getting off the deck, put an end to just a horrendous season to start the 2024 season for the New York Metropolitans. They fall to 0-5 after falling apart in extra innings surrendering a 3-run 11th inning Tonkin in the top of the 11th inning, losing game one of a split doubleheader between them and the Detroit Tigers, who up until their walk-off win later on that evening were the last and lone remaining undefeated team in the sport. There are no more winless and no more undefeated teams left. Mets get the job done, winning the game 2-1 in walk-off fashion. Pete Alonso ties it in the bottom half of the ninth inning. And obviously they get the walk-off hit shortly thereafter in the bottom of the night. That courtesy of Tyrone Taylor bringing in Brett Beatty. That's a tongue twister there. The Mets currently sitting at 1-5. They're a mess. They can't hit. They can't pitch. I mean, everything is wrong with this team. This team is fundamentally broken. I mean, it's a flawed roster. Every single valuable trade piece that they have, I'm talking Alonso, I'm talking Edwin Diaz, I'm talking if he can ever find his way to hit in the month of April, which he hasn't in eons, Francisco Lindor. Every single valuable asset that this team has on this roster has got to go come deadline time in the middle of the summertime. This team has to go 2018 Orioles and rip it down and start from scratch. It'll suck. It'll hurt. It's the worst. It'll frustrate you. It'll have you questioning your fandom and questioning life, and it will leave you so pissed it'll be hard to put into words. But for the betterment of the franchise, the Mets have the advantage because at the time of their rebuild, unlike ours, they didn't have the frugal Angelos family at the helm, so they got money to burn. But even in baseball, you can't buy yourself a championship. Obviously, what the Mets learned over the last 2 seasons with a piss poor farm system, a few, albeit great players, but old and older players with a variety mix of role players that were vastly overpaid. They got to tear it down and start from anew. They just, for the betterment of the franchise going forward, they have to. They cannot continue to go at it the way that they did, again, with 1 foot in, 1 foot out, as they did heading into the season. Trying to get Yamamoto and Ohtani, they got neither. Okay, finally got J.D. Martinez, great. But J.D. Martinez played on a team that had Freddie Freeman and Mookie Betts on the team. And the only bat in his lineup that you honestly fear, but not even fear to such an extreme degree, is Pete Alonso, and that is the end of it. And even if JD Martinez has another JD Martinez-esque season, what's it going to do if the team can't pitch and can't get batters out in the bullpen outside of Edwin Diaz is pissing down their leg every single time they toe the rubber? So it just can't happen. In terms of the Dodgers, Mookie Betts, I mean, he leads the National League in hits. He leads the National League in hits, walks, OPS, slugging, on-base percentage, runs, home runs with five. He's second in the National League right now in batting average, hitting out a smoking .457 to begin the new season. And he's second, one RBI behind his teammate Teoscar Hernandez for the National League lead in RBIs. Take a look at the Dodgers right now. Obviously, they're going to be cruising their way to another 100-win season. They have begun the season after they came from the two-game trip over in South Korea, where they started the season 1-1. They have gone on and gone 6-1 here in the United States ever since. They got a 7-2 record, not that it means anything, but a two-game lead over the defending National League champion Arizona Diamondbacks. At the time of this recording, they are up 2-1 in the bottom of the second inning against the Chicago Cubs. They are winners of They came to start the season in the United States against the Cardinals, in which they won 3 out of 4 last weekend, and they swept the San Francisco Giants over the course of this week, Monday through Wednesday, 8-3, 5-4, 5-4, coming off of an off day. They got a road trip where they play in Chicago for 3, then visit the Twins for 3, and they come home actually for a hefty homestand against the Padres, Nationals, and the Mets, and they don't hit the road again for them to take in part of a mighty road trip of their own, where they head east to play the Nationals and the Blue Jays, and then head out west to head leaking into the month of May, where their road trip will end May the 1st against the aforementioned defending National League champion Arizona Diamondbacks. In terms of where you stand with the NBA, Joel Embiid returns, played solid the other night on Tuesday night for the Philadelphia 76ers. 76ers, obviously, if you need a reminder, beat the Oklahoma City Thunder 109-105. Embiid stat line, just to give you a nice refresher, he played 29 minutes of game action, 26 points, 6 rebounds, 7 assists, 3 steals, shot 42.9, 43% as a whole from the field. If the NBA last night, the New York Knicks are without Julius Randle, obviously, who injured his shoulder earlier in the season. They got news earlier in the day yesterday that he would be gone for the season, which was a tremendous blow for the Knicks, because honestly, you take a look at the New York Knicks, a team that's so well coached, so tough, so clutch as a unit, as a team. You know, I say it all the time, there's a difference between a team, T-E-A-M, and a collection of players that happen to wear the same uniform that are on the field or on the court at the same time. The New York Knicks are the embodiment and are the primary example of what a basketball team, T-E-A-M, team, should be and is, and that's what they have been. And on the day in which they get the news that Julius Randle's gone for the season, what do? They step up and at home against a feisty Sacramento Kings basketball team, step up and get the job done and win by 11, 120-109. Josh Hart, what a tremendous month of basketball he's been playing. 31 points, 9 boards, 8 assists, 2 steals on the night. Shot 73% from the field. He could not miss. Dante DiVincenzo chipped in with 21. I mean, it's just a collective effort. They even got Bogdanovich off the bench, who played 12 minutes and scored 12 points and had a sensational night last night. And Jalen Brunson, 38 points, double-double, 38-11 with 2 rebounds, shot 60% from the field himself, 40% from 3. I mean, just a basketball team. A team. Now, you can quibble and you can scream about how Coach Tibbs, Tom Thibodeau, how he stretches out his players, and he has his players when they're up 15, up 20, you know, with 3 minutes to go in a regular season game in a month of, you know, in a month of January, early February, he still keeps the starters in, which enables his players to get worn down like this throughout the dog days of the season, where they're limping to the finish line to get to the playoffs in mid, late April. But, hey, you take the good with the bad because this team bounces back. They're mentally tough. They get the best out of each other, and they demand the best not only from themselves, from each other. They hold each other accountable and to a high standard. They just play collective winning basketball. And you take and you compare that to just the absolute horseshit and garbage, and I mean garbage, you get from the damn Milwaukee Bucks. I mean, it's a breath of fresh air. It's night and day. The Milwaukee, how in the hell late in the season they go into Washington and get their asses handed to them by the pathetic, lowly Washington Wizards? I could be 500 years old and I'd never figure out how the hell they're able to do that. I have a simple idea because Doc Rivers can't coach his way out of a paper bag. Losing 117 to 113 on Tuesday is absolutely inexcusable. And they come home and they turn around on Wednesday against the Memphis Grizzlies, and they heading into the game had a record of 26 and 25 and 50, and they lose the game by 10 points. And I got to hear Doc Rivers bitching and moan about blaming the locker room people and making all these excuses like assholes, Doc. Everyone has them, and more likely than not, they all fucking stink. I don't want to hear it. I mean, you allowed GG Jackson and Jaren Jackson Jr. to drop 35 and 15 amongst each other. You do the math. They scored 50 points. And you had Goodwin and Clark come off the bench and score 27 points. I mean, you kidding me? And I understand, you know, you got Damian Lillard there if you're Giannis, and he feels the need to take over these games late. I mean, they brought Damian Lillard over so Giannis can do less in crunch time, not do more. I don't understand it. And the defensive game plan with Doc Rivers is just absolutely just disgusting. I mean, they bitched and moaned about their previous coach, Foster, who they fired in the middle of the season, trying to improve their defense. Well, take a look. They've given up 113 to the Atlanta Hawks. Okay, that's March 30th. They've given up 117 to the Wizards, 111 to the Grizzlies, and that's just in their last three games. That's not including when they gave up 129 to the Phoenix Suns on March 17th. They gave up 122 to the Celtics on March 20th. They gave up 128 in the double overtime fiasco a couple of Tuesdays ago on the 26th of March at home against the Lakers, a lead they blew late courtesy of Doc Rivers' idiocy. I mean, it's just... You cannot be more incompetent as a basketball coach than Doc Rivers. And how in the hell this guy still continues to have a job? For the life of me, I live to be 500 years old, and I would never in a million years find a way how that's the case. This is dumb. And I look at them, they're the second best team in the NBA by record. In terms of at their best, give me the Knicks. To be the challenger to Boston at the top of the Eastern Conference at 60-16. Currently riding a 3-game winning streak, winners 8 out of their last 10, who have lost only 3 games at home this year. Give me the Knicks. At full strength, full health, even without Julius Randle, I take the Knicks 9 times, all 10 times. Every day of the week and twice on Sunday to really show some teeth and to put Boston on their heels and to really see if the dog is within Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, who have been rather feeble and underwhelming in April's and in May's past with the Celtics in playoff time. Give me the Knicks and a Celtics 7-game series in the Eastern Conference Finals. You can have the Milwaukee Bucks and Doc Rivers and their first-round playoff exit. I'll pass. And Jimmy Butler in the Heat with 32 and 34 7th seed, whatever. I'm taking the Knicks. 45 and 31 and only 2 games back of aforementioned Milwaukee for the 2 seed. Give me the Knicks and the Celtics in a 7-game series. And I hope and would love to see them upset them and go to the NBA Finals. The question and the key is, can the Knicks make it? in the event that they make it to the Eastern Conference Finals, can they survive and not kill themselves along the way and wear themselves out so they can get to the Conference Finals at the end of the day? That is the question. On the Western side of things, it's going to be the Lakers and the Warriors 9 and 10 in the play-in. The Lakers and the Warriors have both caught fire as of late. Warriors have won 6 games in a row, 7 out of the last 10. The Lakers have won 8 out of the last 10. Winners are 3 in a row, both over 500. Warriors are 42 and 34. Lakers are 44 and 33. The Lakers have a game and a half hole between them and Phoenix, who is currently the 6th seed, that is the first team to avoid the play-in, that have already clinched the playoff berth. And Golden State is 3 games back of aforementioned Phoenix, who are 45 and 31 as the current 6th seed heading into game action here on Friday afternoon. In terms of the NFL, you have Hassan Reddick, who is a newly member of the New York Jets, who got traded about a few weeks ago. Week or so ago, he should be able to help bolster the pass rush, join Quentin Williams and the crew to help bolster the pass rush and improve that team defensively, which fell off as the season went along, in large part because of the defense was so damn terrible. But he should be an effective help for the Jets defense coming forward in 2024. And in terms of the best roster, here's the thing also, and kind of tie it into the whole Trayvon, the whole Stephon Diggs news with the trade. The thing about the AFC East, and we haven't gotten to the Warriors draft yet, and I understand it's only early April, but the thing about the Jets that's interesting, they have the best roster. Not necessarily the best collective team or the best quarterback, but they have the best roster, say, 2 through 53, maybe 1 through 53 if you want to bring in Aaron Rodgers into the equation and throw Zach Wilson to the Wolves. They have the best roster in that division, top to bottom. They by far have the best roster in terms of defense, and they have the best roster in terms of offensive talent and weapons. Which, wide receiver, okay, well, maybe not wide receiver. But outside of wide receiver and maybe offensive line, they got the best defense top to bottom of anybody in that division, and the best running back rooms in anybody within that division. And if you want to include Aaron Rodgers, hey, a healthy Aaron Rodgers is better than Josh Allen. You can flip a coin. I won't debate you. Either way you turn or think. I won't debate you or fight you off on it. A healthy Aaron Rodgers a healthy Aaron Rodgers is obviously better than any quarterback that the lowly Patriots are going to have this season. And he's a better quarterback, obviously, than Tua. But is a healthy Aaron Rodgers better than the best of Josh Allen? I don't know. That's a healthy debate and healthy conversation to have. But as good and as superior as the Jets roster is compared to their contemporaries, the lone reason why, and again, I understand it's early and it's just fodder for podcast conversation, but the one reason why I would be hesitant to pick or bet or favor the Jets to win a division is their head coach. Robert Saleh is not a better head coach than Mike McDaniel. He's not a better head coach than Sean McDermott. He isn't. And I'm not saying Sean McDermott, again, is Vince Lombardi or Mike McDaniel's Don Shula, but depending on how the season plays out, he could be, in terms of real X's and O's, he could end up being the worst coach in the division. Even worse than newly hired head coach Gerard Mayo. And if Gerard Mayo ends up not necessarily having a better team or necessarily having a better team or a better record, but if you get down to the nitty-gritty and you evaluate Gerard Mayo compared to Robert Saleh, and he has a better season than Robert Saleh has, just in terms of what it takes to be a head coach and decisions that he makes, and even head-to-head record, Patriots versus Jets, if Robert Saleh again finds a way not to beat the New England Patriots without Bill Belichick for the first time, the New York Jets aren't going to make the playoffs. Like I told Adam Schein on Instagram a few weeks ago, that, yeah, the Jets have a playoff-caliber roster. They have a roster that can win a division, but they don't have a head coach that reflects their chances of that reflects their good chances of them making the playoffs and or winning the division. They don't, let alone winning a playoff game or making the championship Sunday, winning the Super Bowl. Yeah, their roster's good, but look at their head coach. They still have a last place, pathetic, and over his head, feeble head coach. You know? Regular season, would you rather have Robert Saleh head coach or Sean McDermott? Would you rather have Robert Saleh head coach regular season, September through December, or Mike McDaniel? Would you rather have Robert Saleh as your head coach or Andy Reid? Regular season, not playoffs, obviously, regular season. Would you rather have him over John Harbaugh, regular season? Would you rather have him over Mike Tomlin, regular season? Would you rather have him over Zach Taylor or Kevin Stefanski, regular season? Would you rather have him over Jim Harbaugh, regular season? Would you rather have him or Sean Payton, regular season? Robert Saleh is so far down the pecking order of AFC head coaches that run circles around him just in the regular season alone. It's scary. If Andy Reid, Jim Harbaugh, Sean Payton, any of the coaches in the AFC North, Sean McDermott, Mike McDaniel, Doug Peterson, or D'Amico Ryans was the head coach of New York Jets, I'd say, yeah, without a shadow of a doubt, the Jets are the best team in that division. Even after, especially after the Stephon Diggs trade. But even after the Stephon Diggs trade, can I go out and fully pump up my chest and say with my chest that the Jets are the best team in the division prior to the draft in early April? I can't even say that because I don't know what the hell I'm getting with Robert Saleh. I don't. He's this team's pitfall. And Stephon Diggs, who, I mean, we have hatched it back in January. Do I have to go back and punch it up for you? 8:17 to go, fourth quarter, down 27-24 with first and 10. He catches that pass with 8:17 to go in the fourth quarter. It's first and 10 at the bare minimum Buffalo inside the red zone if that ball is caught. Not to mention your boy is $350 richer, but that's not a hint nor there. He catches that ball. It's first and 10 Buffalo inside the red zone. At the bare minimum, best case scenario, he scores a touchdown, and Lord knows what the hell else happens from there. And so he drops the ball, a play here, a play there. Tyler Bass shanks the game-tying kick wide right, and the Chiefs advance to the AFC Championship game. But for that play to be the final play of Stephon Diggs's and the lasting play that, you know, the play that's forever burned and etched into the minds of Vikings fans for his career with the Vikings is the Minnesota Miracle. The play that's going to be forever etched in the minds of Buffalo Bills fans is his drop pass in that game. That and him standing out there on the field in the 2020 AFC Championship game looking for who struck John and why. And yet he got his opportunity again in his own building and he collapsed like a cheap tent on a clearance racket at your local Bass Pro Shops. So, and the Bills didn't get that much for him either. What, a second round pick? Not even this year's draft, 2025. Now, they did him a favor shipping him off to a contender, but it goes to show you about how it's a reflection of Stephon Diggs' ability going forward that the Bills essentially aren't getting immediate collateral back for him. Now, does it make the Houston Texans better? Absolutely. Do you look at and heading into the draft and heading into the spring and upcoming summer and saying to yourself, damn, the Houston Texans are the best team in the AFC South? 100%, absolutely. But you still got to be able to play the games. And Buffalo, listen, I don't know. The whole window of the Super Bowl conversation, we said it when they got knocked out of the playoffs back in January, and I'll rehash it here again in April. It's not closed. It's just their window has just gotten a lot harder for them to make it to the Super Bowl. after last season, this past season, 2023 season that concluded in the winter of 2024, it's not going to get any easier for the foreseeable future for the Buffalo Bills to make it back Championship Sunday, and in turn making it to Super Bowl for the first time ever with Josh Allen as their starting quarterback. It's not going to get any easier from here on out going forward. If they get the Championship Sunday or Super Bowl, 59 in New Orleans this upcoming season, they will have earned it. Because it ain't going to get any easier for them going forward. So the window in terms of their easiest path to get to the Super Bowl, it's shut and slammed dead in their face. But to say that the Super Bowl window is closed entirely, not fair to say. It hasn't. Their Super Bowl window is not closed entirely. It's just gotten harder for them to execute with their window being open. I put it to you like this. It's like having literally a window open, and a window's open it's open 6 inches. Window's open 6 inches. You're given a football, given a baseball in your hand, and you're told, throw that baseball through the window. And rather than you having all of this room to work with trying to throw the baseball through the window hasn't closed entirely, but it's gotten to the point where the space of the open window is about as much as the circumference of the baseball itself. So it's not closed entirely, but it just got a lot harder for you to throw that baseball through the open window. That's how I equate the Buffalo Bills Super Bowl window is right now. After their loss to the Chiefs, and reminded of it now in the aftermath of the trade of Stephon Diggs, it's gotten harder. Now, the one thing that they have in their favor is that they're a team that can, and this is also after the fact that they shed payroll to no end and they were cutting players left and right when the free agency period began last month. The one thing they still have in their favor is that they had arguably the best and most talented quarterback within that division in Josh Allen, which is a bonus, and they have the best regular season head coach, not playoffs, but best regular season head coach out of the bunch, and that's McDermott. McDaniel, for all of his offensive genius, they have problems beating Buffalo in the last two seasons. Furthermore, they can't beat teams above 500 to save their life. Buffalo, we know when their backs are against the wall, they can. We've seen them do it plenty of times. And the Jets, we just discussed it with Robert Saleh, who is just, I mean, the guy, getting him to beat the lowly Patriots was sitting through a root canal for Jets fans. So, I mean, what do you anticipate up against real opponents? I mean, it's like, come on. But there you go. Whiz through baseball, the NBA, and the NFL, just like that. And before we go, we actually have two voicemails we want to get to before we say goodbye. Let's see what we have cooking here. Let us start with, let's go to Michael Jett in Atlanta. Wants to sound off on the MLB schedule makers here to begin the 2020, the 2024 campaign. Michael, the floor is yours.
Major League Baseball schedule makers, what are we doing? Why are we starting the Major League Baseball season that starts in April in cities like Philadelphia and New York and Chicago, where it rains all the time and it snows? What are we doing? Teams are already having to navigate cold weather injuries, postponements, and awkward days off. I mean, the Braves had to move their opening day game back a day in Philadelphia, and then they had to travel to Chicago, where they were lucky they got any of the three games in the Windy City. They ended up playing two games, both under 40 degrees, and they had to postpone the third one, you guessed it, to snow, sleet, and rain. And now they have 72 hours between their postponed game that should have never been played in the first place and their home opener on Friday. 3 full days off in the first week of the season. Are you kidding me? Players hate it. Fans hate it. Everybody hates it. What are we doing? Why can we not get this right? Baseball should not be played in 30-degree weather unless it's November in Game 6 or Game 7 of the World Series, which, for the record, will be in Baltimore or Atlanta with my Braves facing off against your O's. Get your crap together, Major League Baseball schedule makers. Alas, I digress. F the Mets, the Phillies suck. Let's go, Braves. Jet out.
Appreciate the voicemail, Jet, as always. He does great work, by the way.
Major League Baseball schedule makers, what are we doing?
Works for ESPN as we fool around with the voicemail. Shout out to Jet. Thanks, buddy, for the voicemail. He does great work, by the way, for ESPN videographer. Check him out on Instagram if you can.
The thing with the whole, first 2 weeks of the season and baseball being played in essentially football weather and games being rained out and the whole clusterfuck that becomes of the early parts of the baseball season, it can be avoidable on two things and two things only, and it would never happen because in order for it to happen, baseball would have to take away streams or avenues of them making money. Which means they'd have to do one of two things. Either A, get rid of the wild card series, which is the reason why the season began as early as it does now. It used to be the earliest that it would begin in March was March 31st. Now it's bled into March 28th. And the reason why they have that is because A, they don't want the regular season bleeding any more into the month of October than it already has, because we don't need a World Series being played essentially the week before the week or the week and a half before Thanksgiving. That's the first thing. And because with the expansion playoffs, where you have to have, three extra playoff dates on the front end of the month of October, they have to begin the baseball season at a decent part, in the month of March to get the first March 28th, 29th, 30th, 31st. They have to start the season, where they're at least three to four games into the new year, into the new season, before April 1st rolls around, because they have to deal with the expanded playoffs in early October, which thus pushes the World Series into the first, 4 to 6 days into November, so they have to start the season that early. The alternative either is to get rid of it altogether, which they'll never do. But a more plausible reason I think could be easier accomplished in terms of making sure the season starts essentially around this time, where the weather isn't entirely as horrible as it was, a week and a half ago, is shorten the season to 154. If you shorten and truncate the season to the way it was back in the old days, 154, you can start your season, you can start the season essentially the second week of April. You can have your opening day as, this upcoming Monday, April the 8th, or next Thursday and Friday, April the 11th and 12th, if you ultimately wanted to, which is a whole 2 weeks later than the opening day that was on March 28th. The weather isn't as cold, temperatures in the 30s and 40s like you brought up. It's more so in the low 50s at best, low 50s into the low mid 60s. You get a little bit of the nasty weather out of the way. Like, for instance, with the Orioles and the Royals series, they had to wait 5 hours to get game three in on Wednesday afternoon. And in the first two games of the series, the weather here was absolutely disgusting. It wasn't great for their game last Saturday against the Angels, but able to get the game in. And the weather wasn't all in all that great on Thursday. There was rumors that the game could get postponed last Thursday, Orioles home opener, because it rained all throughout the week and was nasty earlier in the morning. It was cold, wet, damp, And really, outside of the game on Sunday, the weather here for the Orioles' first home stand of the season was awful. And outside of Saturday and Thursday last week, nobody was at the stand because the weather, in part because the weather was so horrible. So, and it also has a negative effect on the attendance figures because fans say, "Hey, my kids are still in school. I'm working. You know, baseball is not the sport where, unlike football, you can go to and thoroughly enjoy sitting in a stadium, you know, for hours upon end, freeze your ass off. Baseball is not that kind of sport. I'd rather go when it's 90 degrees and sunny outside and go, and I can go in my shorts and flip-flops and a t-shirt rather than bundling up in stadium blankets and sleeping bags like I'm about to go to the NFC Championship game in Lambeau Field in mid-January. Baseball is just not that kind of sport. So fans say, you know what, I can wait and not necessarily, you know, fork up the especially if you're a fan of a good team that plays, you know, in this horrendous weather. You know, if you're a home opener, it's a different story. But if you're a Yankee fan, or if you're a fan of a contending team that you know is going to be good for the most part throughout the course of a season, you're not going to go out of your way outside of the home opener to send yourself to the poorhouse and freeze your ass off buying tickets for the game when you got all of May, June, July, August, and September when the weather is more nicer and more enjoyable and you got 70-something other home games at your disposal. You don't have to basically force yourself to go to a game and freeze if you don't necessarily want to, which is a great benefit that the sport of baseball has that the other sports such as football necessarily don't. You know, football, there's only, 8 or 9 home games. If you make the playoffs, 10, 11 home games at the most, and it's a once-a-week thing. Where, you know, the Raven fan was going to go out there. I understand the playoffs is a different element of conversation, but the Raven fan was going to go out there and, you know, and with temperatures in the teens to watch their Ravens play rather than first few home games of 81 with the Orioles and 50 degree weather, and they chose not to freeze. So it's a good point, but it's all avoidable if they get rid of the wild card series and shorten the season 154. I don't think they're going to shorten. They're obviously not going to eliminate playoff teams. 154 to also eliminate the drudge, slog of the season, middle of the year, would obviously be a tremendous benefit. But if they start 154, it gives them that two and a half week window where they can start the season the first or second week of the month of April. Furthermore, they can also avoid the inconvenience of starting their season right in the middle of the NCAA tournament. You know, a week ago, was Sweet 16 of the men's portion of the college basketball tournament. You start your season, you know, next week. If you start it on a Monday, it's the same day as the national championship game, which isn't played till 9 o'clock at night. And if you schedule it right, all your games will be done by the time the national championship game starts at 8:45 Monday night of the national championship game with men's college basketball. You start it on the Thursday or the Friday. There's no games during the twilight mid afternoon. You have to go up against, but it is a major problem, and it would require a lot of work. But I could see how there could be a way for teams that play in the Mid Atlantic, North Midwest, and the northeastern part of the United States for those teams not to open up their season, if not on the road, for them to open up in either warm weather climates or open up in places where teams have domes. Milwaukee, Toronto, Tampa, Miami, Arizona, like the Houston, like with the Yankees, their first two games of the season, they opened up playing in domes. The Red Sox opened up their season out on the West Coast. But the problem is, if you're a Red Sox fan, you won't be very good, but you haven't seen your team play since September, you know, when they came here and lost 2 out of 3 to the Orioles to close out the season. You haven't seen them play in eons. You'd like to see your favorite baseball team play just to begin the new season, and you got to stay up till 9:45 at night to watch your team play their first 6-9 games of the season, which to the East Coast baseball fan isn't exactly fair. So It's a complicated dilemma that has no quick, direct solution to the problem. But I appreciate the voicemail from you, Jet, nevertheless. And I do think that it will be, Lord willing, your Atlanta Braves and my Baltimore Orioles playing in early November for the 2024 MLB Championship, a.k.a. the 2024 World Series. I hope that's the case. I believe and I think with my heart and my head that's going to be the case, but we got a long ways to go. But yeah, there's no easy solution or easy answers to the first few weeks of the baseball season, where the weather across from the mid-Atlantic all the way up north to Boston, and in the northern Midwest cities, Minneapolis, Chicago, Detroit, you know, there's no easy Kansas City, there's no easy solution. There isn't, because unless you shorten the regular season, you're going to get the horrendous winter-like weather to begin the season. You're going to get rainouts. You're going to get temperatures in the low 50s throughout the 40s, wind swirling all over the place. I mean, hell, Orioles and Pirates, the Pirates home opener in Pittsburgh, it's snowing. Like, actual, like, snow that you can visibly see, like you're watching a football game middle of December at Lambeau or at Soldier Field. It's snowing. So that's, unless the only way to fix it without doing anything to the schedule doing anything to the game count is to start the season 2 weeks later than it did. But on the flip side, the World Series is going to bleed into late November when the weather really gets chilly. And God forbid you have a World Series between the Detroit Tigers and the the Mets, for a perfect example, and it's ice cold frozen in those two cities after the first week of November hits. So there's no easy solution, you know, and you compare it to all the other opening days and MLB seasons in years past, you know, if you want to talk, you know, 1940, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, you have to keep in mind, it was American League, National League, the first place of each league, and it was World Series, and the season was over, you know, with about a week and a half, 2 weeks left to spare in October. Not to mention when the baseball season began back in those days, then the season was, at the time, was 154, and even when it was 162, it didn't have to go up against the behemoth that is the NCAA tournament that has the nation's attention Thursday through Sunday in the last 2 weeks of the month of March. Furthermore, with the World Series, they didn't have to worry about baseball. At the time, was a bigger sport than the NFL was at the time. I didn't have to worry about the ratings for the World Series getting destroyed and getting suplexed by regular season NFL football, and even college football to a certain degree, which is what Major League Baseball has to deal with now. So baseball is a victim of the sport of football being the most popular sport and the most watched sport nationally in America. It's also a victim of the growth in the phenomenon that is the NCAA tournament. And like all the other sports, over time and as years go by, you add playoff teams and you add games onto your regular season schedule, you know, it creates the mess that it did. But Jed, I appreciate the voicemail. And finally, what would it be without a voicemail from Mike in the OC?
Oh, Jai. It's Mike from Orange County. How are you?
What's going on, Mike?
Jai, how about my Angels? How about that 4-2 start? How about Ronnie Washington? How about what he brings to the club?
The first two to us.
Even with that loser Anthony Rendon on the baseball team, trade him. If anybody has a bag of chips, we will trade him to your team for a bag of chips. So please inquire.
Why in the hell would my team want Anthony Rendon?
Pray Manassi.
He stinks. You just told me that he stinks.
You remember 1979. Win a championship. Well, you don't remember it, but people around here remember it. Angels, Orioles, a first division title. You guys beat us 3-1. Could we see Angels Orioles again in the playoffs? Can I dream? Is it possible? We'll see. It's a nice start for the Halos. I'm glad we got a game off your Orioles. It's a little rainy in Southern California today. We got those Red Sox here who always beat us, so it seems. So let's see what goes on. Have a great baseball weekend. And we'll talk soon, my friend. Over and out.
Yes. Thank you, Mike. Yes, 1986 with your Angels losing to the Red Sox in the 86 ALCS. And obviously, I do not remember the 79. Is that Russo? I do you remember the 2001 Seattle Mariners? No, I don't. I don't remember the 2001 Seattle Mariners, and I don't remember the 1979 ALCS because I was not alive for either of those two baseball events. Hell, my father was a year old exactly when the 79 ALCS was played. But, Mike, you're 4-2. We've seen the story from the Angels before. In the rare occurrence that they do start out hot, they fade. As the weather heats up, they get worse. So, how many times, Mother's Day, Memorial Day, oh, let's check in how the Angels are doing in their seasons in the toilet. So, granted, you all have found a way to find some momentum after you avoided getting swept by us on Sunday. But it's got to be a little bit more. You got to give me more than 4-2 for me to take you guys seriously into being a contender in an American League, in which I told you, leading up to the beginning of the season last week, I told you guys, I am hard-pressed to see where a new playoff contender can fit into the six team round of musical chairs for the 2024 American League playoff field. You're going to have the winner and a second place team in the AL East. That's two teams. You're going to have the winner of the AL Central. That's three. So already, without even thinking about it, that's three teams. That's half the field. You have the American League West winner. That's four, and then you're going to have the second and probably the third place team in the AL West making the playoffs. That's 5-6. And the second and third teams in the AL West, Mike, are going to be either the difference between the Astros and Rangers and probably most likely the Seattle Mariners. And if not three teams from the West, you'll get three teams from the East. So without even thinking about it, Orioles, Yankees, and Blue Jays. So there's no seat at the table for your Angels to make it into a playoff series. It's not going to happen. A nice little start, not bad, but I don't see it. It's got to continue. Let's see our birthday. We share a birthday. It's May 29th. That's a Wednesday. That's 2 days after Memorial Day. If the Angels are playing good ball by the time you turn 80, however old you're turning this year, then we can have a conversation about whether or not the Angels are going to be in the mix to end their 9-going-on-10-year postseason drought for your L.A. Angels of Anaheim, Orange County, Southern California, L.A., whatever the hell they're called. But, Ron Washington, no disrespect, you guys got a long way to go before we start talking Angels and playoffs in the same sentence. But I appreciate the voicemail from you, my good friend. Nevertheless, either way. That is another episode in the books of the Amatella Catalias podcast. If you're new to the program and like what you heard, please do not hesitate to subscribe. Follow your boy on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at the J Shield. Feel free to send a voicemail, email them to me, shieldsjai15@gmail.com for your voicemail to get played and reacted to on the Amatella Catalias podcast. So, until Monday, in which we will preview the men's national championship game and recap and react and analyze the women's Final Four national championship game and discuss any items of information regarding the NBA and Major League Baseball. Peace. Until then, we are gone.